Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. On today's episode, I've got someone who's seen emergency medicine from every possible angle, physician, advisor, operator, and frankly, someone who's been in the room when big decisions get made. So Dr. James Augustine has helped shape how emergency departments run, how EMS systems operate, and how we think about data. So today we're going to talk about what's broken, what's fixable, and what people in healthcare just don't want to admit. Dr. Augustine, welcome to I Don't Care.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I do care. So that's why I'm here today.
Well, thank you so much. Dr. Augustine, tell my audience a little bit about yourself.
Yes, sir. I'm an emergency physician. I trained in Dayton, Ohio. During my medical school time, became a firefighter and EMT, became very interested in data, entered practice, and was brought up by people who have a great deal of experience in emergency department administration and management. In the early 90s, we had our first round of this really weird thing called diversion or rerouting. And that was happening because big departments were getting very busy. Kevin, in those days, a really busy emergency department that was very high acuity saw 100 patients a day.
Wow.
And we kind of called that the threshold to hell, was 100 patient day. At that time, we said, you know, we've got to do a better job and lead our way into being able to manage emergency departments of any size and establish the Emergency Department Benchmarking Alliance. Okay. And I have served with that group since that time. About the same time, the CDC said we need to study these things where so many millions of patients are getting their care every day. Those were emergency departments. And we worked with the CDC to do that. And then, Kevin, you probably remember a group called the Healthcare Advisory Board.
Absolutely.
Which in 1995 wrote a very important document called the Clockwork ED. Mm-hmm. And we worked with them to perfect what was going in this document that was the process map of an emergency department still today serves as the basis by which you map out emergency department operations. So data has been really important. And then the finances have been very important because we have a system that's mandated by the federal government under EMTALA, but requires no money to be going to pay for that. So across all of those systems, it's our opportunity to study, improve, and make sure we have a stable system for 160 million patient encounters a year now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you took me way back to the mid-90s because I remember the Clockwork ED work that the advisory board did. It was tremendous. And it's so interesting that the old threshold was 100 patient visits a day. That at what you said, an active emergency department. My last hospital, we were doing about 200 visits a day for a hospital of roughly 300 beds that covered a geographic area of only 9 counties and 500,000 people. So things certainly have changed, haven't they?
They sure have. Yes, sir.
Let's see. Emergency departments have become the safety net for everything, whether it be mental health or primary care gaps or social issues. At what point does the system just break?
Well, what we have seen, emergency departments kind of operate in 20,000 volume increments is what we have found kind of data-wise and process-wise over the years. And they reach a breaking point where they cannot process adequately and where community systems break down rapidly. Mm-hmm. So it's usually an acute stress. If you have some time to plan for the care that goes on in your community and breakdowns in that care. And Kevin, I want to use an example of a long-term stressor for the healthcare system, which was babies being born. Mm-hmm. If you think about what happened in the post-World War II boom, most hospitals in this country delivered more babies post-World War II than they did any time until we got to the 2000s. Mm. What the people that run labor and delivery units did was begin to practice together and plan together so that there were enough units for predictable volumes of babies to be born across the time, and planning for all of the hospitals and their NICU backups that they needed for the babies. Those are planned and predictable changes in volume that would occur. There was seasonality to that. But no woman ever delivers a baby in the hallway. And there's something to be said about planning that began in the post-World War II baby booms that we missed in the emergency department. And we now don't plan. And it's our opportunity now to be planners and to say our volume's been going up 2 to 2.5% per year since World War II. It certainly has continued since 1992 when this formal emergency department survey was done by the CDC. But when you have a community where a system breaks down, it can break down when the community mental health system goes down. It can break down when a hospital closes. It can break down when there's some sudden disruption in the care system. That's when we have emergency departments that get too stressed and literally staff are fleeing out of them and patients are dying in and or around them. And then the EMS system is brought in. I work with the EMS system. We're asked to make up for the loss of facilities by transporting or by changing our transportation policies, moving people to other communities, et cetera. So some of this is community specific, but as with many things in the healthcare system, if there's slow evolutionary change, we adapt to it. When there's rapid changes is when system failure occurs.
Yeah, very true. Very true. So you've seen ED operations from every angle. What's one best practice that everybody swears by that you think is actually overrated or maybe even wrong?
Blaming emergency department volume issues on low acuity patients. And saying that if we got sprained ankles out of the emergency department, that then we would do a better job managing the care of the worst STEMI patients, et cetera. For those places that think low acuity patients are the source of operational issues for emergency departments or hospitals, that's a really dangerous place to be. The second very dangerous behavior is that boarding is the emergency department's problem and their issue to resolve. And really, this is about the flow of our entire acute hospital system.
I figured you would go to that because that was an issue that I faced in all of my hospitals. You know, the ED got blamed for the overcrowding when it wasn't really totally their fault. And it was more of the throughput issues upstairs and trying to get people discharged appropriately. So it was no surprise about that answer. So if you were given full authority to redesign emergency care in the United States tomorrow, what's the first thing you'd shut down or completely rebuild?
Oh, boy, what a tough question, sir. Let me say our entire healthcare system is broken. We have really siloed much of the care system in our country. I'm at the age where I'm watching my friends go through this, where they can't find a system of care, where I'm asked to intervene because something didn't work. And maybe even I'm going through today, my daughter trying to get care for a problem that came up abruptly a couple weeks ago, and the system won't respond. So beyond the fact that our entire care system is now so siloed, what works well in our system now are focused factories who do predictable levels of care for predictable diseases in low-risk patients. They work extraordinarily well. So we have centers that do cataract extractions or do GI endoscopy, do outpatient orthopedic surgery and other things that work really, really well. They have the finances built around them. They have predictable patient volumes and flows, and they work very well. If you will, the rest of the care system is built around unscheduled care and our ability as a community to absorb the many patients who have unscheduled needs, knowing that that system is what makes the focus factories work. And then follow the money, Kevin. We have a system where the gold goes to our commercial insurers who have very much a profit mentality. We spent a couple weeks ago time at the Emergency Department Practice Management Association talking about the downside effects of the No Surprises Act and how it has broken the system in many ways for patients on scheduled care. It's broken it for the patients, it's broken it for the insurers, and it certainly has broken it for the providers attempting to do care.
No, I would agree with that. Now, you and I met a few weeks back at the Emergency Department Benchmarking Alliance, an organization that I'll be totally honest, I had not heard of until I was invited to the conference. And I'm so glad I came because I was greatly impressed with all of the sessions and with just the passion that not only the speakers, but the attendees had for emergency care. So number one, thank you for that. Thank you for having me at that conference. But you know, we talk a lot about data and benchmarking through groups like EDBA, but are we measuring the right things? Or are we just measuring what's easy to measure?
I'm a little of both, very honestly. We started the Benchmarking Alliance in 1994, addressing this issue of the big, busy emergency departments, and then over the years have extended it. We looked at developing the parameters that best showed the flow of patients through the emergency department and what safe flow might look like. And when there were indicators that both flow and operations weren't working, like walkaway rates, that was really important as a starting point. In order to achieve consistency, we have both defined and measured data points that are easy to achieve. And over time, we have had more difficulty in being able to define certain time markers, the effectiveness of certain operations. And then for something as important as boarding, there's a time marker in there that is very difficult to define. And that is when a decision is made on an individual patient that they need the services in an inpatient area. That lack of a definition then results in us having a very difficult time determining when boarding starts and when the emergency department visit ended. With that, we don't have a good measure of how long boarding takes place in all hospitals in order to compare them. Mm-hmm. And at this point, we need another marker of boarding, which is how ineffectively or effectively is the hospital working? So that goes beyond the emergency department to what are lengths of stay, what are the models for staffing hospitals that either lead to efficient or less efficient operations.
So where is the biggest disconnect right now that's hurting patient care between the emergency department all the way up through hospital leadership?
Yeah, I very much now the disconnect is when somebody says, let's keep the chaos in the emergency department. And I have heard that phrase from coast to coast, where it is a strategy of the hospitals to say the ED is our buffer zone for everything that goes on upstairs. It's very difficult managing operations on the inpatient floors, and we don't want to disrupt it. If we disrupt it, it will influence our ability to staff them. Those emergency department people, they can take care of anything. Mm-hmm. If they have people stacked in bunk beds in the emergency department, they'll still take care of them. And if there's no body count that goes along with that, then it's okay. They'll take care of it. Mm-hmm. Until we have, you know, people dying regularly and a community that says we can't accept this kind of behavior, we will continue to have increasing problems in really making the whole hospital work and having the hospital absorb the entire responsibility for keeping people flowing in through the main front door to the hospital, which is the emergency department. Wow. A couple important data points, Kevin, that your listeners may not know. About 65 to 70% of inpatients in the average hospital are processed in through the ED. There are essentially four doors mm-hmm. into the hospital: the emergency department, labor and delivery, transfers in, and mm-hmm. direct admissions. Of the four, in a typical community hospital, about 65 to 70% come in through the ED. If there's a labor and delivery unit, they generally absorb about 15 to 20% of admissions, and the remainder come in as transfers from other hospitals or direct admissions. If we don't appreciate that the real front door to the inpatient unit is the emergency department, we really have trouble. And so that's one very important mm-hmm. data point. A second very important data point is our ability to process those patients greatly influences the finances of the hospital. Sure. And it's very easy for the CFO to say, hey, our high margin patients are the ones who are direct admitted for mm-hmm. elective surgeries. And that's fine for a very small number of patients in most hospitals. But if you look at the overall budget of the hospital, they couldn't stand without the emergency department's processing of patients who are the standard bread and butter admissions that at various times of the year, gets a little busier. And during the times of the year when there are most people in the community, so the snowbird communities, or when more people get sick by our natural viral tendencies, they're coming in the hospital. So we have to consider those two very important factors when we're talking about the operation of the emergency department.
Okay, I've got a question that you may think I'm crazy for asking, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You feel that EMTALA is outdated?
No. Okay. Unfortunately, still very much needed. We have people in the community who acted badly and refused care for patients who didn't have appropriate mm-hmm. coverage. There needs to be access to the health system. Mm-hmm. And the federal government's easy response was to say, we're going to make the hospitals responsible for access to health care in this country. And there's one door that's open 24 hours, well, two, labor and delivery, but that's for a select group of patients.
Sure.
The remainder of access to care has to be through the EDs. If we suddenly made EMTALA dissolve, we would be back to having bad players again.
Okay.
And unfortunately, we still see that in the urgent care settings and mm-hmm. other things where patients are not allowed to get care. They're rejected from receiving services, so they have to have a place to access care, which is in the emergency department.
I knew the answer. your answer would be, but I also see EMTALA really, hamstringing a lot of the hospitals that do have good intentions, and so. But I recognize. We unfortunately are always going to have those bad actors out there that have to have that level of regulatory pressure put on them. So thank you for answering that one.
Kevin, I should have said on the transfer side, boy, there's a lot of difficulties in figuring out the transfer issues that are outlined in EMTALA. And as we have a very complicated health system now with the with growing specialization of service availability, the transfer side of EMTALA is very difficult to apply.
Now, you're really right, particularly for us in my old hospital here in Central Texas. We had 9 to 10 community and critical access hospitals that used us as their tertiary center, where they sent the vast majority of their transfers. But there were a few times that we had some difficult conversations with them because, we felt that what they were trying to, the patients that they were trying to transfer could have been cared for in that local setting, but they either didn't feel comfortable doing that or they didn't have the appropriate physician coverage. And so in a sense, they were dumping those patients on us. And so, You know, I certainly see the benefits of Impala, don't get me wrong, but I also see the parameters that they put around the hospitals that are really trying to do what's right for patients.
I've worked in little hospitals and great big hospitals and seen the difficulty in the transfer issues, as you're saying. Mm-hmm. But imagine, you know, a hospital that's trying to serve a critical access community, and they have one ENT specialist mm-hmm. who every once in a while does have to have a day off or take a vacation.
Sure.
And at that point, they have no ENT services, and they have a patient with an ENT emergency, and they're you know, transferred into the mothership. And somebody at the mothership says, oh, this is clearly a dump because we know there's an ENT and EMT physician who serves that community. That patient should have been kept there. Well, we can't mandate that every day. And there's days that no services are available or they don't have the appropriate staffing of the inpatient units that are needed for care. And so there's a number of factors that go into alleging that somebody does not have services available.
So you've advised on emergency department design and operations. So why do so many brand new EDs still feel inefficient the day that they open?
Well, COVID has made a big impact on our operations now.
Mm-hmm.
Our emergency departments had been struggling pre-COVID to stay up with a standard 2 to 2.5% volume growth
mm-hmm.
At a time when some CEOs and hospital boards didn't appreciate that there were ongoing volume needs and a change in acuity of the populations coming in the ED. An old formula for emergency departments used to be that there was one bed needed per 20,000 ED visits.
Hmm.
I'm sorry. One bed needed per 2,000 ED visits.
Okay.
What we found, in fact, when we surveyed our hospital and surveyed our hospitals, is that the reality of our environment now is one bed is needed per 1,000 population in order to preserve flow. And if you're in a hospital that has to board patients in your emergency department for long periods of time, you need even more space and staffing to accommodate that. So old data doesn't help us. And if somebody is using it in application for a modern ED population, which is very high acuity, likely senior, and likely medical. Kevin, you've been in practice a long time. In my early days, about 50% of the charts in the chart rack in the emergency department were for illness,
mm-hmm.
and about 50% were for injuries. And you used to plan on going back and forth between a laceration and a broken bone and someone with a medical complaint and so forth. Our volumes now have changed very significantly. And at most, 25% of our patients arrive injured now,
mm-hmm.
And about 10%, and in some communities more, of those patients arrive with mental health issues,
mm-hmm.
which the ED in most places is very poorly positioned to try to manage, and oftentimes those patients occupy beds for a very long period of time mm-hmm. and are subject to being moved in and out of rooms by time of day, trying to receive telepsychiatry services while they're sitting in the hallway, et cetera. And then the medical patient population oftentimes is very, very senior, has a number of medical problems, requires an extensive period of time and a lot of use of diagnostics in order to come to a quality disposition decision. And therefore that patient's in a bed until a decision can be made for a very long period of time. So if we have a gap of maybe 10 years in ED planning that we're going through now, we have a major gap in the type of beds and the number of beds needed to serve the post-COVID era population. And that's where I think we are. At that meeting of the Emergency Department Benchmarking Alliance, we asked a simple question. How many of you are planning a minor renovation of your ED a major renovation of your ED or no renovation of your emergency department. Over the years, those numbers would have been very much stacked towards a minor renovation. This time when we did it, there were essentially no EDs represented in the room that had no emergency department renovation plans. There were a very small number that had minor renovation plans, and 75 to 85% of the people in the room said, we're planning a major renovation or a new emergency department. That has never occurred in this country where those kind of planning issues have come about. And a lot of it is because of the gap in hospital planning and financing that occurred around our pandemic operations.
No, I would certainly agree with that. And the mental health issues in the ED are just astounding today. I know at my past hospital, we reconfigured a good portion of our ED and turned it into a psychiatric green zone. That where we could, you know, we had a locked unit there, because as you said, you know, one patient comes to mind that was with us for almost 30 days because we could not find placement for them. And, you know, that's an indictment on Texas mental health care, frankly, because of all the closures of mental health facilities over the years, and particularly state run facilities. But it's something that, you know, even as I was exiting the organization, the talk about a complete redesign of the ED was on the table. So,
yeah,
so,
sure. Yep.
So let's go back in history, and after decades in emergency medicine, what's something that you believe now that you would have strongly disagreed with, say, 20 years ago?
That the ED can solve every problem. That was the mentality many years ago. You throw it at us and we'll take care of it.
Sure.
But we have reached beyond that. The second thing is that an ED can function without the support of the C-suite. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate, my first ED where I practiced, the CEO, the CIO, and the CNO all used to spend time in the emergency department, mm-hmm. and would literally be there watching things go on. They were there on the most important day of the week, which was Mondays, mm-hmm. when we were most busy, and they would help. They mm-hmm. would literally move patients in beds, mm-hmm. and get monitors set up and do other appropriate activities around patient care needs. Their goal was that we would never go on diversion at this mm-hmm. at this hospital, because other hospitals, and I'm long enough that it was pre-Emtala, and we had trouble with other hospitals sending patients to us. Mm-hmm. But our hospital's dedication was that they would never, ever go on diversion, and that we would absorb all the patients that came in, and that they had to have firsthand knowledge of it. We've had somewhat a change in the mentality of hospital administrators, and many of them don't like to go to the emergency department because the environment there appears to them to be not as in control as they would like.
Yeah.
And that really hurts. So our ability to run our emergency department as an isolated entity can't be, as you and I discussed earlier, we're one reflection of all of the hospital services to the community, and have to absorb whatever happens. Kevin, you missed one of the interesting discussion points that took place in the EDBA over the last couple of years. Some of our members strongly feel that the design of the future is a 250-bed emergency department backed up by a 50-bed inpatient unit that's mostly critical care.
Uh-huh.
Some of our insightful members said, we are responsible for so many things in this institution that they should make us the responsible party and only move mm-hmm. other decisions up to a select group who run the intensive care units and the inpatient operating room and cath labs and other things. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the entire institution should be called the emergency department, because that would reflect the reality of what we're dealing with now, and honestly would be a better operational design. So put that in your future model options, is an ED that's that size. You said you grew up in a hospital that didn't have the big inpatient support. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what many people feel now.
That's an interesting thought process. I know a lot of hospitals or a lot of hospital systems in Texas are going to not quite a model of that scale, but they are opening facilities, particularly in the suburbs, that are primary ED with maybe a 10 or 20 bed inpatient capability. And for those, you know, for those locations, it seems to be working incredibly well. But, you know, I know there's a lot of discussion within hospital administration circles about, you know, we do need to really reduce the bricks and mortar and the inpatient beds to only treat those who are more critical. Because, I mean, you've seen the evolution of healthcare just like I have. You know, back in the day, if you had cardiac issues, you were going in full open heart surgery. You're in the house for 10 to 12 days. Whereas now, that very same thing in today's world, most of those are done in the cath lab and you're discharged that afternoon. So, yep. You know, it's just a huge change. But Dr. Augustine, any final words for my audience before we go?
We all should care about the function of our emergency care system. And people need to be very flexible in thinking through the future. One of the things we haven't been able to talk about, but as a build from what you just said, hospital at home mm-hmm. has become a very attractive model. We have that in our community here where I'm sitting today in Fort Myers, Florida, where we are taking care of patients very well in their home environment. Mm-hmm. They get a full diagnostic workup in the emergency department. They get initial treatment done, and then they're lined up for care in their home, mm-hmm. which results in lower costs, better care, better patient comfort, and ultimately fewer complications in that environment. That is supported by a really good emergency care system that if something does go haywire, and that's kind of expected, just like upstairs in the hospital, you can expect a 2-5% complication rate where something occurs. But in the home, when we have EMS that can go and serve needs, mm-hmm. boy, is that a wonderful care model and keeps people out of issues with nosocomial infections and other things. My want for our audience here is that we think of the emergency department as one reflection of the hospital, and we think of the hospital as one reflection of what is needed in acute care in our community.
Good words to leave on. Dr. James Augustine, thanks for being on I Don't Care. This is exactly what I wanted for us to cover today, because there's just a lot in healthcare that we say we're addressing, but it's not like we're actually fixing these things. And your perspective really helped bring that to light. So for everybody listening, thanks so much for joining me on today's episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson, and look forward to seeing you the next time. Take care.